Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You're listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who make the fine art with the needle and the thread.
And well done.
Our guest this week, she does that fine art thing, Allison Cole of Allison Cole Embroidery. Hi, Allison.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Welcome.
Thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
And for the next hour, we get to listen to that beautiful Australian accent. It's going to be wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, it's the best. It's the best. Okay, now the report here says that if I was your high school boyfriend and wanted to spend an evening sitting on a couch next to you, that there would be an embroidery stand in the way.
Yeah, you'd have your legs underneath my frame. Yep. At that time, I was working on pieces of canvas on a frame that was about 4 foot long, so I used to take up the entire lounge. And anybody that wanted to sit beside me had to sit under my embroidery. So,
as a dad of a daughter, see, that would be a huge plus. Yeah. Yeah, well, sit with any boy you want. Go ahead, just any boy you want. That's fine, yeah.
Make sure you take your stitching, yeah.
But that was, in just doing the background work, that was the thing. You started stitching when you were very young, and you haven't quit.
No, I've been stitching for 40 years.
Wow. I mean, because you mentioned somewhere... kids even kind of made fun of you in school because you were always stitching.
And... Yeah, they made fun of me. I used to stitch. I had a 45-minute trip to school on the school bus, so I used to stitch on the way to school, and I used to stitch in my free periods and at lunchtime, and I'd stitch on the bus on the way home from school. And the only time the kids didn't pick on me was when it was winter, because I'd take a crocheted rug. I was crocheting a rug at one stage and all my friends would sit under the rug. And as I worked along it, they'd all turn it so that it would move along.
Allison, let me hold that for you.
So, yeah, in the winter, my friends all used to sit under the rug I was crocheting. So they used to pick on me the rest of the year, but at that point they were quite happy with it, so...
That's true. You know, for a kid, I mean, that's tremendous commitment. Obviously, you've always enjoyed it, but even through school, I mean, at some point, I would expect you'd just set it aside for more, you know, for whatever kids do in school. But
I set aside doing textiles at school. So I dumped textiles as quickly as I could because my mum was a seamstress and she used to say that my sewing teacher wasn't a seamstress's bootlace. And I never got a score below 95% for my textiles at school, and I had a few perfect hundreds, and I'd come home and my mother would make me take it apart and remake it properly. So I stopped doing textiles. I stopped doing textiles, but I didn't stop stitching at home, and I've always stitched. And my mum and I used to joke at one point, she'd say, "Well, I'm the better seamstress." I'd say, "Yes, and I'm the better embroiderer." So we just leave it at that. It was always still my relaxation, even though I did business at school. So, once you got your schoolwork finished, I would then still be stitching and doing things. Same way my daughter, she was doing all art subjects at school, and then she'd come home and her favourite thing in the world is to draw. So she would come home, and she still every night comes home from, well, she doesn't live here anymore, but she goes home and she draws of an evening because that's what she enjoys doing. So, it's always been there. And even then when I got a job, I never used to take tea breaks because I don't drink tea or coffee, and so they'd say, "Oh, we'll just go out and sit out in the waiting room and just have a break for 15 minutes." So I started taking my embroidery to work so I could do that. And at that time, I was doing embroidered pullovers, and the people at work would see them and they'd want to buy them. So as quick as I could embroider them, they were gone. So it was a nice sideline.
excellent. Yeah. So it's always been embroidery?
Yeah, pretty much. I've done, like, my great aunt taught me to crochet when I was 11. My mum taught me to knit when I was 5. So there's always been other things there, but they're not my priority. My priority is always embroidery.
Hmm. So, any particular style or thing that you prefer?
I've always loved gold work and stump work, but they were something that you couldn't learn. So, you know, growing up, it was just surface stitchery. I loved surface embroidery, did canvas work, cross stitch, all the sorts of things that everybody does, trapunto, you know, dabbled in a bit of everything. But, you know, once I got to join the Embroiderers Guild and find out, you know, it was the only place you could go to find out more about gold work and stump work. I was seeing in exhibitions and things like that, but not actually being able to find anywhere to learn how to do it. And up until that point, I was either self-taught or taught by my mum and everything. So, you know, it was a real amazing thing to be able to go out and do classes and learn things in a class and discover that there's somewhere out there that there are people teaching this. And then I accidentally fell into teaching it myself.
From what I read, there isn't really a class you haven't taken, pretty much.
No, pretty much. I landed a job in a needlework shop, in my local needlework shop, because I was there almost every day buying supplies. It was only 5 minutes away from where I lived, so it was a case of, oh, I need a thread. Oh, let's just jump in the car and go get it. And so she'd find that while she was busy serving people, I'd be there helping other people at the counter and saying, oh, no, you just do this or you do that or whatever. And so she said, you know, you just have such a wide knowledge from all these classes that you've done and all the things you've done even before you joined the guild, that would you like to come and have a part-time job in the shop? So, and then would I like to teach? And so it just kind of snowballed. So it was funny, this one day this lady came into the shop and she says to me, oh, you're not Cherie. And I said, no, I'm Alison. And she goes, oh, you won't be able to help me. I need Cherie to help with my crochet and you don't crochet. And I said, who says I don't crochet? She said, oh, I've never seen you crochet. I said, doesn't mean I don't. I said, I did a full crocheted layette for my daughter when she was born. She, oh, okay. And it was just that she was used to using English patterns and it was an American pattern, so a double crochet is a treble. So it was just something really, really simple. So, yeah, it was funny though, because she was just ready to turn on a heel and walk out, because I wasn't the person she thought she needed.
And actually you were, yep.
So, yeah, I specialise in gold work, stump work, because they're the things that I adore. But I love doing creative embroidery. I like doing things that are really left of centre. They're just not always things that you can teach or package into a kit form to put in. So what I do for exhibitions and things is usually still incorporating gold work and stump work, but usually very different to what I have on my website for sale. So it's, I like to do things that are a little bit different. I like to mix things up.
Yeah. So when you're teaching, I mean, you're teaching adults as essentially a very young lady then.
Yeah. I started teaching teaching embroidery when I was 27. So it was a lot of, you know, I was the youngest person in the guild when I joined, and I'm still probably in the lower 10% of it still, so 20 years later.
Bringing down that average, yep.
it's kind of funny. I used to say that when I was a kid, I was a junior member of the Horticulture Society, and everybody I was hanging around, you know, my parents had a nursery, so I grew up around horticulture, and so everybody I hung around with was sort of, you know, 60 and above. And then when I was 15, I started doing ballroom dancing, and everyone I hung around with was 60 and above. Then in my 20s, I joined the Embroiderers Guild, and everyone I'm hanging around with is 60 and above. And I'm still hanging around with people who are 60 and above. I just seem to be catching up to them really quickly.
So. Yeah, that's going to happen. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's going to happen.
Well, no,
yeah.
It's been really fabulous and interesting, because, yeah, sometimes people would come into the classroom and they wouldn't realize I was the teacher. Because I was the youngest person in the room. And sometimes I'd I'd be teaching, say, a intermediate certificate at the Guild, and I'd have ladies that would think that they'd like to tell me how they thought the class should run, because they've been in the Guild for years. It's like all year, and I'm the teacher, and I'm the one answerable to the education committee. So, you know, this is the way it's going to happen. I don't really let too many people intimidate me very much. So.
No, I wouldn't think at this juncture you would. No.
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 Yeah.
No.
And that's, sometimes I have a care. Sorry, as I say, sometimes I have a care factor of zero. So.
Oh, wait, I got to write that down. My care factor is zero. That's a good one. I can use that.
So, yeah, no, some people think they know so much more than you enter the classroom. And, you know, if they don't know me, I don't know how they think that they would know more than me. So
right.
It's just because I'm younger doesn't mean I haven't done a lot of study and a lot of research. And usually, you know, like I say, these days I can tell people I've been stitching for 40 years and they just look at me with their eyes wide open, because some people don't even think I'm 40 years old, which is really nice because I'm way over.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, did you, I don't know if you went to college or not. I mean, have you always had an artistic study, or was this always just something that you did in addition to?
I did business at school, and I didn't even finish high school. I wanted to work in an office. I wanted to type, essentially. I wanted to type and be a clerk, and to do that here in Australia, you have to get in as a junior before you turn 18. And I was the oldest, because of the way my birthday fell in the school year, I was the oldest in the class, and I was going to turn 18 halfway through my final year of high school. And so it was a case of, do I stay at school, get my certificate, then have to go on and become an accountant or something at university, or do I see if I can get in as a junior before I finish school? Because some of my friends turned 18 while they were at uni the following year. I turned 18 in high school. So I started applying for jobs, and I got the fifth one I applied for. So I've always worked in business. And so my parents had their own business, so I think it's always held me in really good stead for having my own business. A lot of embroidery teachers, it's not that they can't make a living out of what they do, it's just that they don't have a business background to be able to organise it. So
yeah.
I think it's been a really good thing to have that as a background. But embroidery is something I've always loved. From before I was taught to stitch, I used to, my favourite thing in the world was just colouring in and cutting up pieces of paper and sticky tape and glue and scissors and staples. And I still like stationery, but yeah, when I was a kid, that was, you know, mum, that would be a really good birthday present, would be just a block of coloured paper, you know, that you could then go nuts with. So
that's so, easy shopping.
My daughter was pretty much the same. So, you know, she was doing, I put a needle in her hand when she was three. And by the time she was 10, she was doing kids' projects for a magazine here in Australia that I convinced them that if they could get rid of one frowsy, boring adult nana project that nobody really wants to stitch and put one kids' project in, you've got the next generation of stitchers hooked.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the next generation of people who are going to buy your magazine. And so one of the editors didn't agree to that. And then when the editor changed, the next editor said that would be great. So Beck ended up doing about a dozen projects for the magazine. She had and a project in nearly every second issue, So which was awesome. And I thought, you know, she's going to be an embroiderer as well. And she loved her stitching. But then high school came along, work, you know, load got heavy, and so she continued working with me in the studio, but she stopped stitching and just kept doing her drawing and things. So, and then beginning of this year, May this year, I lost her as an employee.
Uh-oh.
But she went off and got a job. So
the nerve of her.
She's finished. I know. She finished university. Yeah, and she got a job doing something that she wants to do. So she doesn't work with me anymore, unfortunately. So
I want to go back to the boyfriend. I want to go back to the boyfriend thing, because I want to hear how your husband.
Hours. Well, by the time my husband came along, I wasn't working on big frames.
Okay.
But I was working on tablecloths and things. So he was quite, yeah, he quite frequently had a tablecloth sitting on his lap while we were dating. And he's an engineer, and he's a noise and vibration expert. And at the time, he was doing a whole heap of tests. He was in brake manufacturing, and we did a lot of dating in test cars, where you know, get it up to 100 k's and then brake, and then get up to 100 k's and brake, and then we'd spend the evening driving around and stopping and driving and stopping and driving. And so I was sitting in the front doing my cross stitch the whole time, because I thought I can do a cross stitch in the car, that's fine. So I was doing cross stitch while we were doing that.
Holy smokes, date and you is almost frightening. Jeez. Wow.
People laugh that I have embroidery in my handbag all the time. I don't realize it's been there since my handbag was a school bag. So it's just. We had my niece had a hen's party yesterday, and we had a really beautiful afternoon, no, day before, beautiful afternoon, and there was one of the things was a sheet, one of the games was a sheet to tick off about what you have in your handbag, and one of them was a sewing kit. I said, oh, sewing kit, I've got my broderie in here, does that count? So I got extra 15 points having my sewing in my handbag.
There we go, yeah. Yeah.
Even though I didn't put a stitch in. So no, it's always been there, regardless of whether whether there was a boy around or not. There was always stitching.
That's amazing. And no, you don't have carpal tunnel syndrome or.
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah. No, not yet.
Oh,
I broke my wrist. Ago, that was interesting.
Well, that must have just about killed you. Jeez.
No, I didn't, but it slowed me down a bit. And I already stitch with both hands anyway. I use my left hand, and so I'm applying felt and things, so I like to use my left hand, because I kept thinking, if I ever break my wrist, it's good to have your left hand in. And so I broke my
wait
wrist.
Wait a minute. You literally, you planned ahead for a broken wrist. This is scary. Yeah.
Well, that'll add. Anyway, I did. I'm a bit of a tangle foot, so it was inevitable that sooner or later I would probably fall over and break something. Anyway, So I had a week before I was going to New Zealand teaching, and so I had two weeks. I had 1 week. at home, and then I had a week that we had a holiday booked, and then I was coming home for the holiday and basically getting on another plane and going to New Zealand teaching. So I spent that entire 2 weeks, including the time on our holiday, doing queen stitch on 32 count linen with my left hand, so that I thought, right, I'll be able to teach Stumpwork and Goldberg with my left hand if I can do queen stitch on 32 count. So I clamped my work to the table and was sailing away with it. And, yeah, went off teaching, and the writing is really not so good with my left hand, but the stitching is not too bad. So, And I was doing monogram handkerchiefs for Christian Dior at the time, and I had three handkerchiefs left to go, and I had to have these three handkerchiefs stitched with my left hand to send back. And I had 100 to do.
Oh my!
And I'd done 97 of them when I fell over, and
oh jeez.
Sorry, that's not funny at all.
No, so they went back, and I went, you know, the last three are probably not to my usual standard, but they're as good as they're going to be. So
three so to go, and I have to fall. Oh jeez!
I know, it was stupid.
When is it? It just intrigues me. When is it that you realize you can make a living doing this?
When your husband says you need to finger out and turn it into a real job, or go out and get a real job.
Oh, okay.
I'd been teaching and selling kits and had a small mail order business and it was going along nice. And then Steve said that to me and I said, well, I thought I was meant to be like a stay-at-home mum. And he said, well, yeah, but the kids have started school now and you could be, you know, doing more. And I said, oh, well, I'll stop saying no to work then, because I was saying, oh, no, I think I've got enough work this month. You know, I was being very careful to not overcommit myself with two little kids. And so I just started taking off all over the place. And then Steve started complaining that I was never home.
Uh-huh.
So
be careful what you ask for. Yep.
yeah, pretty much. So yeah, it just kind of got bigger and bigger. And the more things to say yes to, the more your name gets out there. And so, yeah, it got sort of bigger than Ben Hur. And then my husband was, he had changed jobs. And we were building a house. He had a very stressful job and it was stressful building the house. And I said, something's got to give. And we looked at the finances and went, you know what? Beck won't be with me forever. And if you want to come and just work with me at home, that'd be awesome. And so Steve left his job and started working with me. So it's he's out in the shop right now manning this shop. So I couldn't do what I do without him. So
yeah, wow, yeah. that's a flipping of the tables there. Yeah.
Well, it's awesome because we're both a lot more relaxed.
Sure.
We enjoy each other. You know, I mean, we've been married for 27 years. We've been together 8 years. So it's we enjoying being in our new house and enjoying the surroundings. We're in the bush. It's just lovely. And so yeah, when we built the house, we built a studio on the side and a shop area, classroom, and it's fabulous. And yeah, we're both a lot more relaxed. It's really good. We love working with each other.
That's fantastic. Yeah, my wife and I work with each other. We're magazine editors and work at home, and we're in a converted bedroom, the two of us, all day long.
Cool.
And we enjoy working together, and we just think it's the best arrangement on the planet. But we've encountered more than one person who says, I don't know how you ever do that.
Yeah. Well, I said, for me, my mum and dad did it. My dad left work to work in mum's nursery. So, you know, hers was the same thing. So, you know, for me, it's not such a foreign thing, but I do get that some people don't get how you can do it. So it's,
yeah.
So, yeah, I've got friends who I think would kill their husband if they were under there, you know, around them all the time. So,
yeah, we know some people like that too. Yep. And I was intrigued by the you built a house and the studio, and I didn't realize that there was a shop as part of that too, a retail shop.
Yeah. So it's just it's a small sort of retail shop with a classroom area set aside in it, so that I can teach from home. I said to Steve, you know, the time will come when I'm not wanting to travel around the world like I am, and I just might want to still teach but not travel. And I said, it would make more sense that while we're building the house to build a shop area and a classroom in, so that when I could start teaching from home now, we can have the shop open. So the shop's open 2 days a week. And other days by appointment, just so that, you know, if I'm away teaching, I'm not here. But if I'm home, I had somebody pop in yesterday and who just wanted some fabric, and she had rang me on the Friday, and I said, yeah, no, can't come Monday, that's fine. So, it's really, it's good, and it's just ticking over nicely. It's not really, really busy, but I didn't expect it to be either. You know, it was a long-term thing that when I, you know, it might be another 10 years before I decided I don't want to travel. So, you know, but it may, in 10 years' time, we mightn't be able to afford to build it. So with the cost of everything going up like it does.
Yeah.
So it made sense that while we're building the house, we build the studio. And I had a separate studio to the house at their last house. And so we were always going to build a studio, but we always had to have a storeroom, but we needed to look at what we thought we needed for the shop classroom area. So it was interesting when we went to get the house built, you know, trying to go around builders and things, and they're like, you want two houses built? It's like, yeah, pretty much, because my studio was about the size of my mum's house.
It seemed like it was of some size, and I assume that you have a design area for you, just a personal area too. It seemed like that you had quite a space there.
Yeah, we do. The personal area is more a work space, like for packing kits and things like that, not for stitching. I still stitch in the house, unless it's a day that the studio's open, then I just stitch in the classroom area. But usually, if I'm designing or stitching or whatever, I still want to be in the house with Steve, or if the kids are here, or, you know, especially when the kids were here, I don't want to be out on my own out in the studio when I've got a family. So I still use the kitchen table a hell of a lot. And at the minute, it's about 6 inches deep in needlework from one side to the other.
Excellent.
So, you know, yes, I have a beautiful big space that I could be working in, but then I'd need to pack it up and come inside so that I can stitch them at night time. So I generally have something that's portable that I can take out and work on in the studio. I've always got multiple projects going. I've got about 5 different projects on the go at the moment. So there's always something left out there to work on out there, and something in the house, something in a handbag, something in a frame.
Sounds about right.
Yep. This embroidery has taken you all over the world. Boy, there aren't too many places you've missed.
There isn't. No, it's been really amazing. So it's I'm very, very fortunate. I don't enjoy airports and I don't enjoy airplanes, but I do love meeting people, and I don't get a whole lot of time to look around the places where I am. Generally, I fly in and they throw me in a car and show me whatever's in their local area, and then I teach for 2 days and fly out again. So I don't get a lot of sightseeing time in, but it is really cool. And then I've had a couple of trips away where I've just gone away to do research and travelled. And so it has taken me all over the world. It's really fantastic. I've seen more of America than a lot of Americans, I think.
Probably.
Some people in my classes who've done maybe 3 or 4 states, and I think I'm pushing 18 to 20. So it's nice meeting people. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and to be able
met lots of really nice people.
Right, and to be able to see needlework in all parts of the world too.
Yeah, it's just fabulous. And I think probably the best part, it's kind of the worst part really, but the best part is that, you know, you go into a museum like L'Accademia in Florence, and you go in there and there's 10,000 people all trying to take a photo of the Statue of David, which, you know, and there's all these guards running around saying, no photo, no photo. And then you can go and look at an altar frontal from the, you know, 14th century that nobody's looking at. You can have the whole altar frontal to yourself. So I was in a different museum, the San Giovanni Baptistry Museum, also in Florence, and I spent 3 hours with 27 Onoe panels. And the guard kept coming in and just checking on me and walking out. And this man came in, an American tourist. He came in and he looked at me and looked at everything, and off he went. And he came back about a half an hour later, and I was about another 2 feet further along. I'm sitting on the floor with all my bags around me, and I'm sketching and taking notes and photographing the pieces and photographing them close up, sort of section by section, in a grid, so, and writing down what's of importance in each grid so that when I go home I can study them without thinking, now why the hell did I take that photo? And so he comes up to me and he says, okay, so tell me what's so important about these that you're still here. and the guard was there, and she was killing herself laughing that there's an Australian tourist telling an American tourist all about the Italian embroidery. You know? And I didn't see anybody else for the rest of the day. My husband and then children had left me, come back and checked on me about an hour later, and I said, no, I'll catch you, go off and do your own thing, and I'll find you after the museum closes. And then it was really funny. about 6 o'clock, the museum closed and I walked out, and apparently the kids and Steve had bets going that I would be dragged out of there kicking and screaming. And I said, oh, no, I can walk out on my own 2 feet. But you know, so it's exciting and wonderful, but it's sad at the same time. You know, there's not a lot of information on a lot of these embroideries. There's no books to buy. You know, they've got this most wonderful collection of something that's so very, very special that, you know, there's only 3 sets of in the world, and there's absolutely nothing about them and nothing written in English either. No. So, you know, if you can't translate Italian, you know, on the hop, you don't have a clue what you're looking at. So it's sad that not enough people are interested in the needlework for them to be able to put out publications and things like that. And they say the Alta Frontal at L'Accademia is just such a special piece. It has pearl work on it from 200 years before pearl work showed up anywhere else. Mm. So it's a very, very special piece, and there's not even a postcard of it. Mm. So it's sad in that respect.
Yeah, yeah. But for you,
it is
easy.
Very cool.
Yeah, for you, very accessible and all the time in the world. Yep.
It is, yeah. It's really awesome. And I think the other thing that I'm really lucky with is that because I've I guess gotten famous, that I have a name in the embroidery world, that now when I go places, I can contact curators and say, you know, this is what I'm studying at the moment. Have you got this? Can I have a look at it? And usually the answer is always yes. You know, so it's really cool to be able to go behind the scenes and study things that people don't normally get to see. So it's very special.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes any trip worthwhile. Yep. So do we stitch on? Oh, I'm asking you if you stitch on the plane. Of course you do.
Of course I do.
you stitched in test cars. Of course you stitched on the plane. Never mind. Just never mind.
Planes, trains, and automobiles.
Just never mind.
I have a gorgeous little pair of silicon-handled scissors. They're so tiny, you're allowed to take them on planes. And they come with a little scabbard that's joined onto the handle. And so I never hide my sewing. It's always just in a clear plastic Ziploc bag shoved in my handbag. And the scissors are in there with it and the needles. And it just goes through security without any hassle whatsoever. I have a bigger hassle trying to get my shoes through. So anyway, I get on the plane. Once I'm on the plane, the scissors come out, they go on my bra because they're so small. Yeah, they're easy, and they're so small. If you drop them, they disappear down the crack in the seat, and you'd lose them. So, but you say they're small and they're soft handled, and with a little soft scabbard on them, I just tuck them in. And sometimes I forget they're there, and I can fly in home at 5 o'clock in the morning and catch a bus back to Ballarat, and then spend the day here and whatever. And then that evening, get undressed. And go, oh, what's that? That's the scissors. The contact was still there. So, yeah, so it's they're really neat little scissors, though. They're absolutely super sharp. They're fantastic. So once upon a time I used to travel with all my threads pre-cut, so I didn't have to worry. I'd just start with a waist knot, finish pulling my thread through to the front of the work so you don't get tangled in it. And then when I got to wherever I was going, I cut out all of the cut all the knots and the tails off. These days I just take my little scissors with me because I can.
Right.
I don't have to get off at the work looking hairy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm about to, in a few days, fly to Germany, and I already have my this time it's needlepoint, all packaged up and ready to go. And I upgraded the seat, and I've got a lap stand, and I'm just, you know, on the way. Because I don't do well on the flights up to 4 or 5 hours, I'm okay. But those long 9 and 10 hour flights to Europe, I struggle with. And so, yeah, I'm all set. Yep. But I know the scissors you have, the ones I have are, they have a plastic thing. You have the ones that are attached, the little scabbard thing is actually attached, right?
Yeah. Awesome little scissors.
Yep. Yeah. So I've got mine all lined up. Yep. Ready to go. I have to
excellent.
I have to get over the see it for me. It's the male stitching thing. So I have to get over that. But on a long flight to Europe, I've discovered people just really don't care at all.
No, so, yeah. They're sleeping. They right. don't really. They're not even looking.
Yeah. So.
So the question is, do you take your magnifier and light as well?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Because that's where I draw the comments. When I'm sitting there and I've got a headset magnifier and a headset light and I'm sitting and I've got the earphones on because I'm watching a movie at the same time, mm-hmm. multitasking. And that's where I draw the looks and the comments. It's like, yeah. Can you stack anything else on your head?
Now, my light is a clip-on that clips onto the lap stand, and my magnifier is on a string, hangs around my neck.
Okay.
But then I have Bose noise-canceling headphones and yep. and an extra battery for the when that, you know, because it'll die. And, I sit there in my own little world. Yeah, yep.
And it's a great little world, I reckon.
Yeah, it's perfect. Just leave me alone. And as Christine and I have talked about many times, when you work in the business world, when you're on a plane is really the best time because they can't get to you. You
know? No, that's right.
Yep.
Your phone's turned off. It's awesome.
Yep. Yep, they can't get to you. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, book publishing. Oh. Book publishing. Boy, you dug your feet in when it came to book publishing.
Well... I was kind of left in the lurch by a publisher, so I decided, well, let's publish it myself. I've been promoting it. I don't feel any fear in doing it, so I'm ready to go. And Steve felt fear in it because I was going to add a great big chunk of money onto our mortgage, so he was a bit worried about it. And I said, no, look, I can't see it being a problem. There's no other book like it on the market. I have people asking me all the time, you know, about project books, and there were no project-based goal work books at the time, so everything was technique-based, and people would come to class and they'd learn how to do techniques, and, you know, they could reference that back to their books and things that they had, but there were no project books, and the fact that any goal work design is really just a line drawing, you could use any basic line drawing and colour it in, and people just sort of didn't get that, so I said, well, you know, I had three different publishers saying that they wanted to publish me. And so I said, okay, let's do this. And I had friends who'd published books and they would tell me how, oh, God, you know, just been hassled and hassled and hassled until I've got everything done. And then they come back and say, oh, I don't want these three. I want another three and, you know, and want them by next week because we can all just
right.
turn out a piece of needlework that quickly, can't we?
Right, yeah.
And so I decided I was in the box seat with three different publishers wanting to publish me. I would actually write the book first and then I'd give it to them. And then I was working under my own steam and I didn't have to worry about anybody pushing me and annoying me. And so that was fine. And went to the publisher that I already had a working relationship with and said that she was the one that I'd decided I would go with. And then she decided after a few months of backwards and forwardsing that she just really didn't have time to do it for maybe a year or so.
Oh, my.
And it was like, oh, Hank, that doesn't really fit in with what I had been working on. And so anyway, it went backwards and forwards a bit. And in the end, she said, oh, I just don't think I can do it. And I said, fine, that's all right. Thanks for telling me. And got home. I was at an exhibition opening at the time, so I drove home, cried all the way home. Got home, pulled out the Yellow Pages, looked up publishers, looked up self-publishing, made an appointment for like 2 days' time, and had the book rolling. So I'd already arranged. I'd been asked to be a feature artist, touring interstate with Craft and Quilt Fairs and promoting this book, which she then decided she wasn't going to do.
Oh, so boy. Well, you were really left in the lurch.
Yeah.
But it was, I guess, partially my own fault that I believed that she really wanted to do it, you know, and she kept saying, I'll send you a contract, and never actually did. So I guess probably in the back of my mind I was suspect of it anyway. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was awesome because it meant that as the publisher, Yeah, the publisher is the person who puts the bill and takes all the risk, but it's also the person who gets the most profit out of the book as well.
Right.
So as a publisher, I then built my first studio with profits from the book. Yeah. So I was really, really stoked, and I really enjoyed the process. And by the time that book came out, I had the second book written. So that came out rather, you know, so the first one was 2006, next one was 2008. The third book has 7 years of my life in it as far as research and things. So the Stumpwork Masterclass book took a bit longer. And it was never going to be the next book. So the book that was going to be my third book got bumped and bumped and bumped, and it's been bumped again. So,
well, that's the case. Anybody I've ever talked to who published a book through a publisher, the only way that they actually made significant money was if they were out promoting the daylights out of it to sell copies.
Yeah.
That publishers are terrible at marketing, or just don't have any interest. So if you self-publish it, you really put yourself in a strong position in terms of not only promoting, but then you don't have that percentage coming off the top every time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you say, I know people who get 40 cents from every book that gets sold, and it's like, that's great if you're selling a ton of them. But if you're not selling a ton of them, 40 cents, it's just not worth writing the book for. So, so for me, you know, I'm not doing huge volumes of books like Search Press would do. But the subjects that I deal in is a very niche market anyway. You know, when you look at embroidery as okay, so if you look at hobbies and then you take embroidery out of that, you know, it's only a very small proportion. Then you take gold work and stump work out of that proportion.
Yeah. Those of us who do stump work are a very tiny, tiny subset.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, there's any need to publish any huge mountain of books, of my books. The number that I'm printing, I feel comfortable printing. And, you know, they can go to reprint. So the first book went to reprint. The third book went to reprint. Second book I printed too many of.
Oops.
You learn these things. Well, it just meant they didn't have to go to reprint. So, it's been really good. And, fourth book we printed more of because we thought it had a wider appeal. So it's the Hints and Tips book. And I was talking to Sue, who runs the sales side at Inspirations, and she said, I can't believe that book still sells really, really well considering it's now a couple of years old. So that one came out in 2016 and it still goes in the mail nearly every day. So
yeah, that book there, that's really a versatile book for anyone who stitches, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, so it was it came about through having students asking, you know, all these wonderful things you say in class. Why don't you write them down and make a book? You know, and it's like, well, I guess I could, you know. And so it was just sort of something that evolved. And at the time I was president of the Parents and Friends at the Kids High School, and one of the teachers was running a media club, and he came in and was giving a report on the media club and how he's got these kids doing posters and menus for local restaurants and things like that. And so my brain went, I could do the Hints and Tips book and the kids could lay it out and we could do this. And my brain went into overdrive and I talked to him about it. He got excited and I went home and wrote three quarters of the book in one afternoon.
Oh, geez.
and I then carried a notebook around a class for the next 2 years to get the hints and tips that don't come out very often. You know, the putting your screw at 12 o'clock on your hoop comes out every class. You know, how to use dressmaker's carbon comes out in every class. Things like that come out regularly. But things, you know, when somebody accidentally cuts a hole in the background fabric, you know, the size of a dime, fixing that isn't always, that's not an everyday occurrence. Actually, that one, that happened just after the book came out, so that one didn't go in the book. So yeah,
volume
so
two.
So for two years, I carried around a notebook and was writing down extra things and typing that in, adding them in. And when I discovered that everything I was had gone for a few months, that everything I went to add in was already there, I went, right, it's finished. But by that time, this teacher had left the school and the media club had fallen apart and didn't exist anymore. And I went, oh, well, just do it myself again. So off we went again, self-publishing and doing it that way. So, and yeah, it was really good.
So, now, listener Beth in Illinois is going to laugh when she hears this, because I swore that now our last two guests have been Susan O'Connor and Trish Burr.
Yeah.
And so I bought three of Trish's books, and the newest Inspiration book and a print subscription to Inspirations. And so I said, all right, you know, we can't have keep having these guests because they're killing me.
Yeah. And, right. Book sales.
Yeah. But I will admit that before we recorded this, I was going to buy the Hints and Tips and Hints book, Hints and Tips book, but I couldn't get it in the States. So everything, all the books go through you? Is that how you do it?
I have, there's a number of shops that stock them in the States.
Oh, okay.
And there is Ruth Kern Books has been distributing in the past. I'm not sure whether she's still distributing, but I know she takes orders and gets me to fill her orders every now and then.
Okay.
But no, I do have a number of shops in the States that do stock them. There's one in, oh my goodness, I've gone completely blank.
So basically I didn't look hard enough.
No, yeah, you can find them. Denver, Colorado.
Oh, that shop, yes.
And yeah, and there's one in Baltimore. So
okay.
Is it Baltimore? Yes. Can't think of the name of her shop now, but her name's Christine as well. So, but yeah, it's it is available there. But yeah, most of the time they're available through my website. They're available through Australian distributors and shops and things over here. They're available in the UK. I've got a UK distributor. American distributors haven't been so excited to want to pick them up. Don't know why, because over here the distributors love them, so they sell really well. So, but you know, I ship them over the States all the time. Probably my biggest problem with them is probably the cost of shipping, because while I try to keep the cost of the books as low as I can, but when the first book came out, they said, oh, this book should be selling at $60, the crowd that I was using to do the layouts and that. And I said, yeah, that's really good, but a book that's $60 won't sell as quickly as one that sells for $40. So, you know, we worked out the figures and I said, no, I can afford to sell it for $40. So when people complain about the postage, I kind of go, yeah, but the book's meant to be $20 dearer than what it is. So, like, my $50 book could be selling for $80 if you want to compare it with other books the same sort of, you know, size and content. But yeah, so this is where do you have an $80 book that you sell with free shipping, which everybody will just scoop up, or do you have a $50 book with $30 of postage, which people then go, oh. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what we're toying with doing, is making the book dearer. For the book I'm working on at the moment, the book might be dearer, but it'll come with free postage. So, you know, it's really weird. People don't seem to mind paying more for something if they're getting free shipping, even though it adds up to exactly the same figure.
Right, right, yeah. Perception, yep.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, in the Hints and Tips book, what are your three favorite?
Three favorites. Help, I stitched my embroidery to my skirt. Time to ask yourself how much you really like that skirt. I don't know. Always start a new project with a new needle. That's probably the biggest hint you can give anybody. Always start a new project with a new needle and needle the thread. Don't thread the needle. You know, have the tiniest amount of thread poking through from your fingers and take the needle mm-hmm. in between your fingers. It threads every time. When people tell me they can't see to thread a needle, I laugh. And I stand there in front of them with my eyes closed and thread the needle. Eyesight's got nothing to do with it. It's not having an inch of thread poking out from your fingers, because the minute it hits the eye of the needle, the surface tension on the eye of the needle will make that thread bend. you've got to have just the tiniest bit of thread. It will thread just about every time for you. So it's no eyesight required.
Yeah, so but I have a needle threader, see?
See, I never use one.
I know.
That's something I have to go find.
needle threaders are not something I use. And then when I get to a needle that I do need a needle threader for, the needle threader won't fit through it, like a number 15 beading needle.
Right.
You know, exactly. And the big hint is if you need to thread a number 15 beading needle to go through a particular bead, it's probably going to be easier just to poke the thread through the bead. I've had my students do that as well. So look, it's like, no. Just take the needle off, thread the thread through the bead like you're threading a needle, because it's actually easier than getting it through a 15 beading needle.
Yeah, I suppose there is that point of no return on that. Yeah, just skip the needle. Yep. What's the strangest hint that's in that book?
Strangest hint? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I think probably the ones that get the most comments is actually the hints on the classes section. So it's the book's divided up into, getting started. You know, you've never stitched before. What do I put in my work bag? Through to general stitch hints, through to hints for gold work, hints for stump work. Then particular problems that you might, you know, weird fudges, things, you know, to fudges to fix things, because I've always believed in fixing rather than unpicking. I unpick if I have to, but I'd rather fix it. And then it's got hints for classes, and people are usually, and hints for taking photographs of your needlework as well. And it's usually the one about the classes that gets the most comments, because people think, oh yeah, I didn't think about taking a cushion, because I usually stitch with a cushion behind my back. The amount of people who say, oh, I've just got new glasses, I didn't bring my old ones, I'm not used to stitching with these. You know, if you've just got new glasses, take your old ones. Mm-hmm. You're not used to your new glasses yet. If you stitch with a light and a magnifier at home, take them to class. I've lost count of the amount of people who've said to me, oh, I usually stitch with a light and a magnifier at home. Why have you not brought one with you? For me, if you usually stitch with your shoes off, take your shoes off. If you usually stitch with your feet up, grab a chair and put your feet up. If you're not comfortable, if you're not in your same, I mean, in a classroom, you're already not in your usual stitching environment anyway. If you can try and make it a little bit closer to your usual stitching environment, you'll probably get more out of the class, because you won't be busy squirming that your seat's uncomfortable and complaining about the plastic chairs and, you know. So, yeah, they're probably the ones that people say, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that. So yeah. They're not weird, but they're just they're observations. So. I guess my favorite in that section is don't get your requirements list out the night before the class.
No.
and don't expect the shop to have everything 10 minutes before closing time, the day before the class. It's funny how many people leave things to the last minute.
Yeah, that's got to be any shop's biggest headaches. Is there's a project coming up, people are lining up to buy stuff, but you can't anticipate it, yeah.
No, and you don't even – I've had a tutor contact me who is teaching for our summer school at Melbourne Guild, and she said, now I've put you down as a supplier, this is what I've put on the list as a requirement. So thank you, so that I can make sure I've got enough of everything. You know, it's I've got that and that, and that's all in stock anyway, but I'll make sure I've got some extra, seeing as you've put me down as a supplier. So it's handy when somebody gives you a heads up.
Yeah.
Is gold work material? You're going to have to come back because we haven't asked about gold work and stump work. So you're going to have to come back for another show because we're about out of time here. But
No worries at all.
Yeah. So we got to do a whole show just on that. But is gold work material getting harder to find, or is it just knowing where to get it?
No, it's knowing where to get it. Okay. It's no harder to get than it's ever been. There's absolutely no issues with production. Shops have generally never stocked it because at the end of the day, there's not enough. It's like we said before about publishing. There's not enough people doing it to warrant the stock shopping it. You know, it tarnishes before they sell it, or they've got it on display and somebody comes along and goes, "Isn't that pretty?" and squeezes it, crushes it, then it's unsaleable. So it's not hard to get, but you need to be able to, you know, you want to support your local needlework shop, you go in and you say, "This is what I want." They can order it in. It's not hard for them to get it. But it's just, unless they've got a large number of people who are doing gold work, they're not going to stop the threads, because at the end of the day, they're just going to discolor before anyone's even used them. So
it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that gold work intrigues me, and I have to say I got you owe me about an hour of my life back because I got sucked into your website, and you owe me. But
you only lost an hour.
that's because the phone rang. It wasn't by choice. No, the phone rang. But we asked Mary Corbett, you know, about gold work and how tough it is. And she said it really isn't. It's just you just have to be patient, and it doesn't go fast. And it intrigues me because what you do with that is just amazing visually.
Yeah, I love embroidery that makes you want to sit up and take notice of it. Mm. You know, you can look at a cross stitch and go, "Yep, that's nice, that's pretty." You know, you can look at a piece of crewel, "Yep, that's nice, that's pretty." A piece of canvas work, but then you get a piece of stump work or a piece of gold work, and it commands your attention because it's dimensional and it's sparkly and it's, you know, it makes you look at it. It makes you stand there and look at it. So, and even myself, when I go to exhibitions and things, I just went to the Bendigo branch of the Guild's exhibition on Friday, and you know, there's some really, really beautiful pieces on display, but the things that people stand in front of longer are the stump work and the gold work, because it really intrigues people about how you can make it three-dimensional. And especially with the gold work, they look at it and think, "Oh my goodness, you know, I hate stitching with that stranded metallic thread." They just don't understand that it's not stranded metallic thread, and that it's really not that hard. Yeah. So, it's a bit of smoke and mirrors. So, you know, there are elements of it that are hard, and there are elements that are dead easy. So, but I think it really intrigues people. I think the other form of embroidery that does that is Japanese embroidery. Play on light of the flat silks and things that just gives it such a life that you just have to stand there and look at it. So they're probably the three most expensive things to get hooked up into as well.
We had a lady at our Needlework Guild come and do a program on Japanese embroidery, and afterwards, I'm sure I just stood there with my jaw on the floor, because that is just mind blowing what they do.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Years and years of study too.
I don't have the patience, and I can't keep quiet. Apparently, you have to be very zen and very quiet and meditative, and that's not me.
That one's out. Okay. Allison, it's been a real treat. Thanks for making time for us. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
You're very welcome, guys. It's been lovely to spend time with you.
We've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll be back on Wednesday.